When we go through upgrades and we do construction at Fort Greely and we do the military planning, it is not for the next 10 years. It's for the next 20, 30, and 40 years.
Exploring the future of missile defense in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 12th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Iditarod accepts another large gift.
This comes as incredibly welcome news, particularly given our financial challenges.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
A leaking underground tank released 142,800 gallons of diesel fuel in Adak yesterday evening as it was being filled from a tank ship. Most of the fuel was absorbed into the ground, but about 1,000 gallons leaked into the small boat harbor in Sweeper Cove. According to a report from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the storage tank was overfilled and fuel spilled into a drainage system that releases water into Helmet Creek and the small boat harbor. The exact cause of the spill is still under investigation. Coast Guard Petty Officer Charlie Hengen said ADAC petroleum personnel have stopped the leak from the 5 million gallon tank. She says that company personnel are using booms to contain the fuel and prevent it from going further into Sweeper Cove.
When the leak began, the ADAC petroleum, right away they deployed their boom, and we have approximately 1,100 feet of hard boom and about 75 feet of sausage boom that has been deployed.
Cleanup crews are also using a fuel recovery tug, a vacuum truck, and a skimmer to remove the oil from the water. Hengen says number 2 diesel is very light and dissipates quickly. Representatives from the Coast Guard, DEC, and Oil Spill Response Organization Alaska Shadow traveled to ADAC today to monitor the cleanup and investigate the incident further. The head of the U.S. Missile Defense Agency, Lieutenant General Patrick O'Reilly, was in Anchorage today speaking to Commonwealth North about plans for upgrades at Clear Air Force Station, located about 80 miles southwest of Fairbanks, and plans for Fort Greely. O'Reilly first talked about threats from other nations. He said the growth has been steady for 20 years and is accelerating, saying there are nearly 6,000 missiles and nearly 1,000 launchers in countries other than the U.S., Russia, China, and NATO.
What we are seeing is there are more countries that are building their own indigenous capacity to produce missiles themselves. There's trends that they have longer ranges, that they are more accurate, that they are mobile and more survivable and easier to operate. These missile systems are written in English and they come with owner's manuals.
O'Reilly says it paints a disconcerting picture for the future. He says he's continually asked why there isn't a buildup on the East Coast rather than in Alaska to defend against Iran. He says he has to remind people that maps are flat, but the world is not.
The closest point in the United States to Iran, unfortunately, is Alaska, and the closest point to any of the Southwest Asia countries that we have concerns about is Alaska. We also highlighted North Korea. So Alaska is in a strategic position for a large percentage of the threats that we are very concerned about, not only today, but ones that pretend to present problems for us for the next couple decades.
Lieutenant General O'Reilly said today there are hundreds of missiles that have a range of between 1,000 to 5,500 kilometers, but he says there are thousands of short-range missiles, and the U.S. has very few assets to counter them.
There is predictions that we'd be facing more than a dozen ICBMs at this time out of North Korea or Iran. About 10 years ago was the predictions. That didn't come into account, but that doesn't mean it won't come into the account in the future.
O'Reilly says testing of longer-range missiles will start next week in the Marshall Islands. He says at Fort Greely, there is extensive work to do to be sure missiles have a long shelf life.
So Fort Greely, we have to plan on its capability being viable in 2032 and 2042 and beyond that. And so that is where I've been for the last day. I spent Sunday at Clear, but yesterday I was down in the missile field in all the silos and looking at the construction and how we're doing.
O'Reilly says many upgrades, including a state-of-the-art power plant, are planned for Fort Greely this year. He says upgrades at Clear Air Force Station are in the planning stages and will get started around 2013. He says it will take 4 years to complete construction and testing at a cost of around $200 million. The Iditarod Trail Committee received another $50,000 donation last night from the City of Nome's Common Council. This comes after four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King personally donated $50,000 to the ITC. KNOM's John Francis has more.
Nome generally contributes $15,000 each year to the Iditarod Trail Committee, but after announcing the race lost nearly $1 million in funding over the past year from withdrawing sponsors, members proposed a one-time $35,000 boost, bringing the city's total contribution to $50,000. With the famous World Arch finish line set in downtown Nome, the Iditarod Sled Dog Race brings a boost to Nome's economy. Nome Mayor Denise Michaels says the additional funds are a way of recognizing the race's impact on the Nome community.
During the month of March, we have anywhere from 800 to 1,000 visitors. It's a big increase for us. And also for our business community, during the winter months, all those visitors that are buying goods, the business community also benefit.
Michaels notes the city is trying to set an example for other organizations and communities.
We hope that other municipalities and other sponsors will also do the same kind of a donation in the spirit of giving and supporting this great race.
ITC Executive Director Stan Hooley says the extra $50,000 couldn't have come at a better time.
This comes as incredibly welcome news, particularly given our financial challenges, and for the community of Nome to lead the way and wanting to be a part of the solution is really heartwarming.
Hooley hopes the actions taken by both the Nome City Council and four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King, who personally donated $50,000, will inspire others to help the ITC.
We've got a lot of great support for this race. We just hope it'll cause people to take a second look and say, what can I do to help make sure that the Iditarod is successful?
71 mushers have signed up to compete in the 2010 Iditarod Sled Dog Race, which is set to begin March 6th.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a plan to eradicate marmots from an Alaska island. The furry animals were introduced to the ecosystem 80 years ago.
You know, it was all well-intentioned, but sometimes the results weren't what we had hoped for.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. Programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she believes the troop surge in Afghanistan will be effective, although it will likely cost more American casualties. Alaska's senior senator returned from a brief visit to Afghanistan and Pakistan yesterday. She and three other Republican members of Congress went on the five-day trip at the invitation of the Senate's top Republican, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Murkowski says they saw evidence that President Obama's recent decision to boost troops in Afghanistan is already having positive results.
The combination of the American, the NATO forces, in conjunction with a growing Afghan army presence is truly making a difference. Slowly, but it's making a difference.
The group met with Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai, Pakistan's prime minister and its top military leader, as well as the head of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal. They also visited a police training center in Kabul, Afghanistan's capital, and toured a street bazaar in the village of Karmsur in Helmand province, the site of heavy combat in recent years. Murkowski says they saw evidence that Afghan forces are contributing to some stability.
when we walked through the bazaar in Garmsur, we were with Marines, yes, but those that were providing the protection for that village were all local Afghani police force. That was who was providing for the level of protection and security in a community that just 2 months before, you were not able to walk freely through the streets.
Murkowski says the extra troops heading to Afghanistan this year will help rout out Taliban forces, but she cautioned that it will be a hard and deadly process.
Unfortunately, I also believe that because of this stepped-up presence in this very, very difficult area, we are going to see greater loss of life. We noted just yesterday, it was the worst day that we have had for casualties in several months, and I think that it's going to step up, unfortunately. But I do believe that, as we have seen everywhere the coalition forces have gone, we have seen improvement.
Murkowski says she was able to visit with a handful of Alaskans during her trip, including a female Army soldier from Anchorage and a USAID worker from Eagle River. The recent tragedy at the Dillingham Animal Shelter that resulted in the death of six dogs was discussed at length during last week's city council meeting. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and has this story.
A handful of Dillingham area residents turned out for the city council meeting to express their opinions about the starvation and dehydration deaths of the six dogs that were under the supervision of the city's animal control officer. That officer has been suspended without pay, and an animal cruelty charge was filed against Travis Barnett on Thursday. The first member of the public to speak to the tragedy at the animal shelter was Dillingham resident Karen Dearlove, who wants the city to get out of the animal shelter business.
All of us had ever heard horror stories about that shelter bear guilt and bear responsibility for better care for the orphaned animals of Dillingham. And I'm here tonight to say that I'll be one of them.
The six dead dogs were discovered in the Dillingham Animal Shelter on December 8th, and that shelter has since been closed. During her city manager's report, Janice Shalansky confirmed that Travis Barnett has been through a pre-termination hearing and will soon be notified of the results of that hearing. The long-term goals outlined by Shalansky include assisting in the coordination of a cost-effective spaying and neutering program, educating the public on being responsible pet owners, and reviewing all facets of the city's euthanasia process. Shalansky confirmed that no one ever came forward to claim ownership of any of the dogs that died in the animal shelter. In response to questions from a couple of media outlets, Shalansky confirmed that Community Service Officer Travis Barnett basically ran the animal control and shelter program since June of 2007, and his immediate supervisor was then Police Chief Richard Thompson. Dillingham City Councilman Keggy Tubbs spoke up in favor of an independent investigation of the incident at the shelter.
Not that I don't have faith in our police department, it's just that it kind of just strikes me a little bit that maybe an independent review of this is needed.
Many of the city council members have received emails, calls, and letters related to the incident at the shelter, including Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby, who once again characterized what happened as a huge tragedy.
It's certainly been an education for me once again about how quickly people respond to, you know, sort of articles and papers and stuff and assume that it's the whole story.
Shortly after Mayor Ruby's comments, she opened up the meeting to get the thoughts of the larger-than-normal crowd that had gathered for the council meeting. Some of the most passionate testimony came from local dog musher Kyle Bleck, who said there's plenty of blame to go around.
I think that facility, when it was running the way it was designed to run, was an embarrassment. And I think as a community, we absolutely dropped the ball on that. And I personally feel very, very bad about that. I was sick for days, as I think a lot of people were, when we learned about what happened. I mean, I don't know how in the world it could have ever gotten quite to that point. I mean, I don't think anyone would have ever, in the wildest dreams, anticipated that that could have happened. But it did.
On Thursday, Dillingham District Attorney Susan Mitchell filed one single count of animal cruelty against Travis Barnett, who, according to the complaint, repeatedly only claimed responsibility for two of the dead dogs in the shelter, while claiming no knowledge of how three of the dogs could have come to be in the shelter. Barnett is scheduled to be arraigned on Thursday, January 14th, in the Dillingham Courthouse. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing a plan to eradicate hoary marmots from one of the barren islands north of Kodiak and European rabbits from a pair of islands near Akutan. All three islands are uninhabited, save for the furry little mammals and the native bird populations. Steve Delahanty is the manager of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. He says the marmots were likely introduced to Sud Island in 1930.
At the time, there was sort of a general practice of increasing kind of game and fur-bearing animals wherever possible. You know, it was all well-intentioned, but sometimes the results weren't what we had hoped for. There are a lot of birds and other wildlife, but probably most famously seabirds, that are really dependent on these islands because they provide areas that historically were free of land-based predators. So there were no foxes and things like that on the islands. And so we have quite extensive experience removing these non-native foxes, for example, from islands and getting a very positive response, very positive wildlife response.
The rabbits were also introduced to Poa and Tangik decades ago. Those are two small islands east of Akutan. Delahanty says while the rabbits and marmots are not directly killing seabirds or eating their eggs, they are changing the habitat for the worse.
Well, it's two different types of disturbance. One is flat out changing the vegetation. When you graze it, you change the vegetative structure, you know, how high the plants grow and things, as well as actually which species will thrive. But probably more directly, there's a competition for nesting burrows. Some of these seabirds actually nest in burrows in the ground. And there seems to be some direct competition, for example, between the rabbits, which are using the seabird burrows. The bird goes in and lays its egg, and then the rabbit comes in and essentially kicks the bird out, and so that bird fails to reproduce.
Delahanty says no poisons will be used in eradicating either the rabbits or marmots.
We have to time the eradication and do it at a time and then and use the right technique at the time so we're not causing any harm to other creatures out there. So we don't want any accidental mortality of whatever nesting puffins or something like that, for example. So we will use carefully trained and certified people to do both trapping and shooting.
The comment period for the proposed plan is open until February 10th.
There's a lot of information available in what's called an environmental assessment, and that's available online, or they can call the refuge office here in Homer, and we'd be happy to get information to people or look at our website, and people can comment into February, and then at that point, the Fish and Wildlife Service makes a decision based on all of those comments. Do we proceed? Do we not proceed?
If Delahanty decides to proceed, the hunting and trapping of the marmots and European rabbits from the three islands could begin this spring.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems, keeping Alaska connected with solutions for small businesses that manage your company's voice and data systems so you can focus on running your business. ACSAlaska.com.
Two Alaskans are heading to the Vancouver Olympics with the U.S. biathlon team. Both Jeremy Tila and Jay Hakkinen are veteran Olympians. Vancouver will be Tila's third Olympics, and it's a venue he is very familiar with. He had his best World Cup result in Vancouver last year, placing third.
It definitely does feel like a hometown advantage, and I spent 3 years of my life living in Vancouver, Canada, so that's kind of where my Olympic dreams gave birth. So it really does feel like I do have the hometown advantage.
Tila graduated from Service High School in Anchorage, but now lives in Utah. He and several other members of the team have a shot at medaling in Vancouver. That would be a first for U.S. biathlon. Kasilof resident Jay Hakkinen came in 10th at the Torino Olympics in 2006. He says all of his efforts in the last 4 years have been directed towards one goal.
We all want to be the first ones, the first American to get the first U.S. medal in biathlon at the Olympics. And yeah, but I plan to be the first one.
Hakkinen is already a three-time Olympian, but his start in athletics is an unusual one. He credits the lure of candy with launching his career. He says his parents didn't allow any sweets in the house, so as a kid he had to bike 20 miles to his grandmother's to get his fill. Hakkinen grew up playing hockey and transitioned to cross-country skiing in high school. His parents signed him up for the biathlon club, and he quickly became one of the best biathletes in the U.S. But he was frustrated with the level of funding the sport received from the U.S. Olympic Committee. He calls the 1998 Olympics in Nagano a complete disaster for the team.
I felt that I had the potential to get the medal, but we were the program, to be honest, was struggling a little bit with support. And to get the belief behind us to say, hey, we can really do this. So that's why the results in 2006 were so important.
Hakkinen says the U.S. team is well-funded now and has world-class coaches. Max Cobb is executive director of the U.S. Biathlon. He says the budget for biathlon was slashed after the Salt Lake City Olympics in 2002, but things changed after the 2006 Olympics.
U.S. Biathlon and the USOC came together after Torino and said, okay, what do we need to make this work? It's not a blank check, but we are willing to invest. And so I think that was a major turnaround for our National Olympic Committee.
Cobb says before Torino, the yearly funding for biathlon was about $250,000. Now it's four times that. The Olympics start February 12th in Vancouver. Students across the Sitka School District are learning about anti-bullying techniques using a new curriculum called Oilveus. With the halfway point of the school year approaching, KCAW's Ed Ronco decided to take a look at the curriculum and whether district staff think it's working.
Pam Stala-Kernin is a counselor at Blatchley Middle School.
A few years ago, we had an expert come in and talk to us about bullying. And it's not like we don't know that we've had a bullying problem.
She says teachers were looking for a new way to address bullying that would help them not only intervene in specific situations, but change the climate and cut down on the number of those situations to begin with. Enter Oilveus, an anti-bullying curriculum that covers all grades in the district. The program teaches students and staff about bullying, what it is, how to recognize it, and what to do about it.
So, Ellie, do you want to come to my party next weekend?
Oh, yeah, that sounds fun.
This is the beginning of a video clip used in the program. A group of girls are walking down a staircase in a school building.
Well, if you want to come and be friends with us, we don't think you should have Lauren at your sleepover next week.
But why?
Well, she acts like a baby, and we don't want to hang out with her anymore.
The scenario is designed to show students that bullying is more complicated than getting into a fight or having someone take your lunch money. And, says Stala-Kernin, it's about more than just two people.
The kids are starting to understand it's not just the bully and the person who's being bullied, but they're the people who watch, they're the people who want to do something but don't know how to intervene. And so they're starting to understand that there's more to a bullying situation than just two people.
The program encouraged students and teachers to come up with a list of hot spots, places in the school where bullying is more likely to take place. Sitka High School Principal Howard Wayne.
The staff have made a real concerted effort this year to monitor some of those hot spots. We do that in between classes. We do it as an administrative staff. Going into the certain areas like locker rooms and things like that to monitor bullying. We've also done it with our coaches.
But increasing vigilance among the staff is only one step. Students are being taught to look for bullying too. Wayne says in his building, students are finding it and reporting it.
A bullying incident will have happened, whereas before we might have had one person tell us about it. Now we might have four or five different people coming in reporting about the same incident. And so that's something that we certainly like to see as a staff member here at Sitka High.
School Superintendent Steve Bradshaw says the curriculum is designed to reduce instances of bullying, certainly, but also to help change the climate among students. And even at his level, he says he's noticing a difference. fewer discipline referrals are making it to the superintendent's office.
Which is a good thing, because usually by the time it hits my level, it's a fairly serious situation. And I think that just the fact that we're putting more effort towards helping students get along with other students is always important.
The program relies heavily on data gathered from student surveys, but Bradshaw says the measurement of the program's success should also show up in other ways.
If we're not having as many fights, if I'm not having as many questions from minority parents about racism, those type of things. Are, I guess, the only way that we could document it.
Wayne, the principal at the high school, says his students took a survey last February, and they'll take another one next month. And while he's seeing changes in his building already, he said the results of that survey and how much the data has changed from year to year will paint a fuller picture. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
KCAW staff wondered what students in the school district thought about the issues of bullying. Student Justin Hulse took a microphone to Blatchley Middle School as part of his eighth grade journalism class to find out. He asked students whether they think bullying is prevalent in their school.
I think it's been relatively mild. Like, you see a little bit of it here and there, but it's not like a huge thing where there's like a group of kids beating up the rest of the school. But for the most part, it's been relatively mild.
So I guess you think there hasn't really been much of a bullying problem?
Yeah, not much, but it's been there.
What do you think the biggest problem with bullying was?
People just kind of having an extremely low self-esteem because somebody like in their family or friends don't really like them, so they think they need to take that anger out on other people. Yeah.
Well, I don't think everybody gets bullied, but I think it's mainly certain kids. It's not like really, really bad, but there is bullying here.
That was Blatchley Middle School students Denver Blackson, Olivia Richards, and Connor Fish. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, John Francis in Nome, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.